I wasn't quite sure how to approach this because casino is such a massive subject. There's so much to talk about. And I have this horrible habit of rambling on really badly. And actually, the clock is here, so I need to position myself in the middle so I can see and don't go on too much. And then I felt of the inspiration of Peter Caddick Adams. And Peter's a great one for doing a mnemonic. So I've decided to do a mnemonic. And I'm going to start with the letter C, if I can get the... There we are. C is for Clark. It's for Lieutenant General Mark Wayne Clark. Wayne was his second name. He's 47 in 1944. Turns 48 at the very beginning of May. And, you know, that's pretty young for being an army commander in the Second World War. He's tall, a bit hawkish, pretty good looking, stands at about 6'4". He's a First World War veteran, has commanded troops... in northwest, you know, in northern France in 1918. Post-war, he's languished as a captain for 16 years. I mean, these are kind of, you know, you've got to be dedicated to stick that out. But as war approaches in the late 1930s, so he starts to kind of make a mark. And George Marshall, who ends up becoming, at the beginning of the war, ends up becoming the chief of staff of the US Armed Forces, has his eye on him. He's a brilliant, brilliant planner, a brilliant organizer. You know, he is a dotter of I's and a crosser of T's. And I think one of the things that's so fascinating about the Americans is obviously they start the war as a very small army, tiny. They're like 19th largest in the world. And their ability to absorb the lessons and grow and develop is absolutely astonishing, frankly. And Clark is one of those because he gets the attention. He comes over in 1942 with Eisenhower to kind of oversee what the Americans think at this time in the early part of 1942 is going to be the cross-channel invasion, Operation Overlord, as it later becomes. It's not called that at this point. It's called Sledgehammer. But everyone realizes very quickly that it's not going to be much of a sledgehammer. It's going to be a light tap. So that gets changed, and they instead decide to go for an assault on Northwest Africa, which is finally launched in November 1942. And while Eisenhower is the overall commander of that, it is Clark who is in charge of planning it. And the bottom line is three invasion forces going between 3,000 and 1,000 miles each all land pretty much on time and exactly where they're supposed to be. And it's pretty successful. And one of the reasons it's successful is ahead of that, Clark has gone in by submarine and had secret meetings, clandestine meetings with Vichy officials in Algeria. So there's courage there as well. He then forms, to command and create and form U.S. Fifth Army from January 1943 onwards. And it is the first United States Army to be formed outside of the United States. And he builds that up and gets earmarked for this for the invasion of Italy, which takes place on the 9th of his part of it, the Fifth Army's part of it, takes place on the 9th of September 1943. And he's dealt a very, very bad hand. When you think that there were 4,127 assault craft for D-Day, the 359 for Operation Avalanche, the Allied invasion of the Bay of Salerno, which is not very many. It's an undercooked operation, and yet he manages to pull it off. You know, they are at one point facing attack by six German divisions and elements of a seventh, and they hold firm. Clark holds firm. He's absolutely everywhere. He's beetling about. He does a really, really good job. And at the end of it, when they've kind of got through it and they've survived the Salerno operation, he writes to Eisenhower, who's still the kind of supreme Allied commander of the Mediterranean, and says, "Thank you for this opportunity. You know, we've made some mistakes. There's plenty of lessons to learn. But you know, I feel immensely proud of what everyone's done." There's a real level of humility to him, and it is amazing to me just how vilified he has become for the River Rapido in January 1944, for where the Texans were slaughtered, the Bloody Rapido, as it became known, for the debacle of Monte Cassino and then Cassino Town, for telling any British troops that he saw in Rome that they'd be shot, for disobeying Alexander's orders. And it's really, really fascinating because when one actually just gets away from the kind of well-trod story and starts peeling back the layers, a quite different picture emerges. So I'm rather a fan of Clark. I think he was cussed. I think he had a massive chip on his shoulder. He was really prickly about the fact, because I think he felt supremely confident in his own ability, but he felt that kind of, he didn't have the experience of some of his British subordinates, or indeed sort of compadres in command. And yes, I think he just felt that very sort of keenly, and he was sort of prone to irascibility and peevishness, which, you know, sometimes in his diaries and things, it doesn't come across particularly well. Sometimes he doesn't quite read the room properly. But none of these things should detract from his abilities to command troops in battle. You know, what he has got is this great strategic vision. He's got, you know, he gets the strategic picture. Operationally, he's very hot. Tactically, I think, you know, he's pretty okay. And he improves as time goes on. Let me just take the Rapido operation. So rather than me kind of telling the whole story of the Cassino battles and the Battle for Rome and Anzio chronologically, what I'm going to do is I'm just going to pick little bits of it and sort of touch on themes and ideas. And Clark is such a central figure to this because it is his Fifth Army which is taking the brunt of the action for most of the kind of five and a bit months from the start of January right up to the fall of Rome. And so I think he is this kind of really key character that kind of runs through the whole thing. And also, his army has just smashed through the first of a double lock system in Italy. So Italy is an utter horror story to fight through because it's just full of mountains and full of rivers. In the valleys of rivers, which the Germans have blown all the bridges, and it's really muddy in winter. It's also freezing cold. And as anyone who has listened to the We Have Ways podcast will know, the winters in the Second World War were really brutal. And they were particularly brutal in Italy. And the hand he'd been given was a really, really tough one because basically the Allied armies in Italy were underfunded, undersupported by the chiefs of staff. And largely because at the same time, while they're trying to kind of fight their way northwards, they're also building up the strategic air forces at Foggia, which is one of the very few flat bits about a third of the way up on the Adriatic coast. And that is really the kind of priority at the kind of higher command level. So the ground forces are getting what everyone else is getting. The other point is that the Allied way of war is to use immense firepower, mechanization to do a lot of the hard yards. But the problem in Italy, particularly in winter, is you can't use that firepower. You can't use air power when it's 10 tenths cloud, which it was a lot of the time. You know, it rained 50% of the time from the 1st of October to the 31st of December 1943. I mean, that's a lot of rain. That's even worse than last October here, which is saying something, as I'm sure you'll agree. So you're doing that. So that means a huge amount of onus is pushed onto the poor bloody infantry who have to slog up these mountains using mules rather than trucks. There's no fire support from tanks. There's plenty of fire support from artillery, but it's a long way behind. So that's a very, very tough ask. And what the Germans have done, their main line of defense is first the Bernhard line and then the Gustav line. The Gustav line is the one that cuts across the leg of Italy and which has the Monte Cassino massive as its kind of sort of key point. But about 8 miles south of that is the first line, the Bernhard line, which runs between the two sentinels of Monte Camino and Monte Simucro. And again, runs all the way across the leg of Italy. And these are absolute total bastards to try and get through. I mean, I cannot even tell you, when you're there, you're standing in the kind of Mignano Gap, and you're looking up at Simucro, and you're looking up at Camino, you just think, how on earth did they did it? And yet they do. They push through. By the beginning of January, they are through the Bernhard line. Now they're pulling up towards the Gustav line, which is even tougher. So it's a hell of an ask. And his job is to try and get through that as quickly as possible and get on to Rome in winter with insufficient support. The Rapido operation is going to be carried out by the 36th Texan Division, the T-Patchers, as they're known. And the commanding officer is Fred Walker, who has once been an instructor to Clark at Staff College earlier on before the war. So he's one of the oldest, I think he is the oldest divisional commander in the US Army at the time. He's about 57, something like that. And he doesn't get given the job of crossing the Rapido until the middle of January, but he suspects it's going to be his division on about the 7th, 8th of January. And right from the word go, he just goes, this is a terrible thing, we shouldn't do this. Everyone knows that you can't attack across a well-defended river, even though the Americans have just got across the Volturno, even though the British have got across the Sangro, even across, you know, and there's examples of river crossings all the way through history. So he gets himself into a complete lather. There is no question that this is going to be a tough operation, but it is also working in conjunction with an earlier operation by the British at the other end of the line near the sea, near Minterno, where they're crossing the River Gariano. And they managed to do this on the night of the 17th of January. There was then a subsequent operation which is due to take place on the 19th. But unfortunately, because of the Gariano operation, the Germans have opened some sluice gates further up in the River Liri, which feeds into the Gariano. And the whole point of this is to make life harder for the British further down near the sea and increase the swell and flow of the river. But what that means is where the 46th Division are going to cross, they have an absolute shocker because suddenly there's this huge gust of river, of water. The water levels have risen, the speed of the current is massively increased, and they simply cannot get across. It is absolutely not their fault, it's just one of those things. The Germans have responded to Gariano, and that's one of the consequences. So consequently, that of drawing away German troops from the Rapido crossing, which is going to happen a couple of nights later, as a result of that, that means the job of the Texans is just that little bit harder. But what Clark gives General Keyes, who is the corps commander, which is the next stage up from the division, he gives them half the US 1st Armored Division. So I reckon they've got about 200 Sherman tanks, 150 tank destroyers, which look like Sherman tanks but have an anti-tank gun, which is a high-velocity gun that can fire a shell at around sort of 3,000 feet per second. And they have a whole host of about 75 quads. Now, quads are half-tracks with a four-gun, 50-caliber machine gun on. They're just going ding, 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 ding all the time. I mean, they don't overheat particularly. They're incredibly powerful. This is the same armament as a Thunderbolt or a P-51 Mustang fighter plane, for example. And these things are seriously useful. They're a kind of light anti-aircraft gun, but put them horizontal, they're okay. Now, the whole point about the river crossing is that Texans cross over in four different places, two regiments, two battalions each, on these river crossings, either side of a little town, a little village called Sant'Angelo in Theodici. And it's in the Liri Valley, so it kind of, you know, if you're up on the mountains, it looks really flat. When you're down there, it's incredibly undulating and tricky countryside. And there's no question, as I say, that the Rapido is a tough nut. But what you really want is lots of suppressing fire. So the problem that the attackers, the infantry, are going to have as they're crossing the river is going to be German machine guns, German mortars, opposite them on the kind of floodplain on the other side of the river. So Clark gives them all this extra assets. Walker doesn't use them. Not one of those tank destroyers, not one of those Sherman tanks is employed during the river crossings. Not one of those quads is used in the river crossings. Why not? It's because Walker's got himself into such a lather that this is impossible, that this is going to end in disaster, that it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. The other thing that's really interesting about it is the Texans have a really, really tough time on Monte Simucro in December, which is one of those two sentinels I told you about just a minute ago. They have a really, really hard time, and they prevail against all the odds, really. I mean, you know, all the things, everything's stacked against them, and yet they push on through, and they do take it. It is an absolutely amazing, amazing feat of arms, really. And what is interesting about the Rapido crossing is the number of American troops that are killed equates to about 23 per battalion that crosses. Battalion is about 900 men in the US Army. So 23 out of 900. A lot get taken prisoner, but actually the number killed and wounded is comparatively small. The number of killed is really small. So I don't think it's quite as bloody as the history would have it. The bottom line is, it's a total cock-up. But I don't think you can lay the fault at Clark. You know, as an army commander, your job is to oversee the bigger strategy, the bigger picture, the operational level, make sure that your subordinates have got the assets they need, and then get them to crack on. So I don't think you can blame him. And in fact, actually, at a sort of congressional hearing that was had after the war, that was launched in complaint by the Texans, he was, of course, completely exonerated for this. The casino operations I will talk about a little bit later on, so we'll pass on to that. The Battle for Rome Can I just want to make something absolutely clear? He did not disobey Alexander's orders. This is one of the myths that's been perpetuated by numerous people. At the time, so the big debate is, in the original plan for Operation Diadem, which was launched on the 11th of May 1944, the final battle for Rome, clearing of Cassino, all the rest of it, poles on the top of Monte Cassino. The original plan was that 8th Army, now moved into the central position, would push down the Luri Valley. On their left-hand flank, on their southern flank, in the mountains, would be the French and US 2 Corps, or both of which would be part of Clark's 5th Army. What was expected was that 8th Army would take the lead, the French and the Americans of 2 Corps would be behind them. At a certain point, there would be a breakout from Anzio, the Anzio bridgehead, more of which in a moment, and the US 6th Corps, which also included British troops as well, would strike across the valley, cut off the Via Casilina, which is the main road from Naples through Cassino all the way to Rome, and cut off the retreat of the German 10th Army opposite 8th Army and 5th Army on the Gustav Line. That was the plan. But what actually happened was the French and the Americans of 2 Corps massively got ahead of 8th Army, who got completely bogged down in the Luri Valley because of the huge amount of rivers they had to cross and because of the huge amount of traffic. There was just a total logjam, and they couldn't get forward quick enough. Not a single German soldier retreated down the Via Casilina. So while Clark actually did send a portion of 6th Corps to Valmontone, which was the cutoff point on the Via Casilina, the road to Rome, he also decided to turn up into the Alban Hills, the Colli Albani. And the reason he did that was because sitting on the top of them was the large bulk of the German 14th Army, which wasn't involved in the Cassino battles at all, but was involved in the Anzio battles. And he thought, I don't really want to send my 6th Corps across the flanks of an army in the hills overlooking me. And I think, when I remember standing there way back when, about 20 years ago, traveling through that valley, looking up at the Alban Hills, and thinking, if I was Clark, I wouldn't want to do that either. As it happened, it all got a bit sticky, and irony of ironies, it was the Texan division who found the gap in the German line. American engineers, I mean, there was the bulldozer is as celebrated a piece of equipment, in my humble opinion, as the Sherman tank, managed to bulldoze a track right to the top of Monte Artemisio, which is one of the key features on the Alban Hills. Tanks went up there, were able to fan out, and it prompted the collapse of the Caesar line, the Caesar position, this German position where the 14th Army was, and collapsed, and they then went into Rome. Clark, there is no record at all of Clark ever saying he would shoot British soldiers if he saw them in Rome. He was definitely anxious about 8th Army pipping him to the post. He wanted 5th Army to get in there. But frankly, 5th Army had been doing a lot of the hard yards on that front, and it was only right that 5th Army should take it. And let's not forget that 5th Army also included British troops, not just Americans. The other thing I think is really important to remember about Clark is that there is no other American general at any point in the entire Second World War that has a larger command than him or a multinational one. Generally speaking, American generals commanded Americans. Not exclusively so. There were kind of Filipino irregulars in the Philippines, for example. There were examples of American commanders commanding British troops in Northwest Europe as well, but never to the extent that Clark did in Italy. He had American troops, he had British troops, he had Algerians, Moroccans, French, Canadians. I mean, that is a lot, and that comes with a whole host of different challenges, all of which I would argue that he met quite well. My final point in Clark is that when Alexander, in the autumn of 1944, was bumped up to be Supreme Allied Commander in the Mediterranean, he had to choose an army group commander to replace him, of the 15th Army Group, of the Allied armies in Italy. By this point, Italy was very much a British show. It was dominated by British forces, and Alexander was under no political pressure whatsoever to choose anyone but a British commander, but he didn't. He chose Clark. Why does he choose Clark to be his successor? Because Clark is the best army commander in Italy at that time. So that's my defense of Clark. And we can now move on, and here he is. I think it's really interesting because he kept a lot of papers, and you see his letters, you see his diaries, you see his irascibility, you see that irritation, that frustration, but boy, does he have a lot of frustrations, and boy, is he working hard. This guy is really putting the hours in every single day. It's like me rushing around at the History Festival for 7 days times 250. I mean, it's an exhausting business kind of trying to kind of keep this show on the road, but as nothing compared to what he's doing and the gargantuan amounts of pressure that are on his shoulders. I mean, just imagine being that when you've got Washington and New York and Churchill sending kind of frustrated messages every 2 minutes. I mean, it's just the frustrations of coalition command which come his way. I think he's allowed to be a bit peevish at times. I think he can be excused that. And I think overall, he is a much maligned general who deserves a whole dollop of greater respect than he's been given. Look at him. He's even muddy. He's right at the front line. This is the other thing. He really does beetle about the front. I mean, as does Alexander, the army group commander, it has to be said, and as do others. But he is a very, very visible general. He really gets stuck in. So A is for Anzio. And again, this is a very sort of controversial part of the Italian campaign. But for my money, I think it was worth the punt. So the idea is, at the end of December 1943, Churchill goes, come on, what we really need to do is outflank the Italian peninsula, which absolutely is the right idea, because going up from the south through the mountains is incredibly difficult, yet it's narrow, and there's loads and loads of opportunities to outflanking. The problem, of course, is the shortage of shipping. And Italy is not the top priority. You know, there's a massive great war going on in the Pacific. There's preparations for the Allied cross-channel invasion, which at this point is still in the beginning of 1944, is still going to be May 1944. Obviously, it becomes sick for June 1944. And they're trying to do something. They're trying to unseat the Germans on the Gustav Line. They're going to have these series of operations, the British along the Gariano on the night of the 17th of January. Then you've got the 46th Division crossing the Gariano on the 19th. Then you've got the Texans doing their crossing of the Rapido. Then you've got further operations of the CEF, the French Expeditionary Force, north of Cassino. So all this kind of sort of constant kind of pressure just hammering away at the Gustav Line. Maybe if we then do a kind of outflanking position to the back, that might just unnerve the Germans and get them to pull back completely up towards the kind of Rome area, and we can unseat the Gustav Line that way. And actually, it's not it might just work. You know, it might do. The problem is shipping, and the problem is that Italy is at the bottom of the priority chain. So what Alexander is trying to do, and what Clark is trying to do, is get as much shipping as they possibly can, even though it's never going to be enough. And it's fascinating because between April 1942 and May 1943, the Americans alone built 8,719 assault craft, but they can only manage 90-odd of the all-crucial landing ships for the Anzio operation. And again, the plan is to kind of land two divisions. If you think about two divisions, is about 15,000 men, plus a few commandos, plus a few kind of 82nd Airborne paratroopers, and a few Rangers. So about 35,000 men, something like that. They can land that on day one, on D-Day of Operation Shingle, as the Anzio operation is called, but not much more than that. Who do you get to command it? It can't be Clark, because Clark is overall commander, but he's also got his hands full with the Cassino front. He's also got to kind of oversee what's going on in Anzio operation, but it needs a kind of ground controller to take it. There's a very, very short list of candidates. Two Corps is already operating in the Cassino front, so it can't be Two Corps. The only other American Corps is Six Corps, which had been pulled out of the line before December, and that's commanded by Major General John Lucas, who's a lovely old fella. He looks a lot older than he is for his 54 years. He's white snow hair, moustache, round specs, usually has a pipe in his mouth, etc. He is the commander, and his job is to try and push on out of Anzio as quickly as possible and get up to the Colli Albani, the Alban Hills, where, you know, high ground is important. From high ground, you have observation posts, which means you can then control artillery, etc., etc. So high ground is good. And that is the idea. And hopefully, that will hustle the Germans into being unseated. Now, Alexander, it's quite interesting, because when you see what he's saying, it's clear that he thinks it's a punt and nothing more than a punt. He quite clearly sees that this might not work. But he also knows that the chiefs of staff, the combined chiefs of staff, so the head of the military, both in the United States and Britain, are simply not going to allow Sixth Corps at Anzio to be kicked back into the sea. That is not going to happen. So he is pretty confident that if they go ahead, it might not achieve what it needs to achieve, but they won't let it fail, which is not quite the same. You know, those two things are not the same. And he recognises that push comes to shove, extra shipping will be found. To cut a long story short, he's absolutely bang on the money, because Anzio doesn't completely fail. It doesn't achieve what its aims are, but it doesn't fail. It is allowed to build up and build up and build up. And as I already mentioned earlier on when I was talking about Clark, Sixth Corps was able to break out on the 23rd of May 1944 and add materially to the success of the Battle for Rome and Operation Diadem. It's a big flat area. It's the Pontine Marshes. This is a fascist Mussolini era reclamation project. This is the Via Anzate and the railway line on the left. This is the road that leads from the towns of Anzio and Nettuno, two little ports, which are ancient Roman ports. And this is the one road, and you can just see faintly in the distance, can't you, kind of looming the Colli Albani. That's the landscape, and it's absolutely, I mean, one should always walk the ground, as anyone knows, but it's a very different place now. It's completely built up, it's full of light industry, it's completely gopping, actually. Anzio town's all right, but the area around about it, it's kind of hard to imagine. You can still see a notorious feature called the flyover, which was going to be a road that hadn't ever been, you know, was going to be a road. War came, Mussolini got overframed, blah, 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 money ran out. They never quite got around to it. Sounds incredibly familiar, doesn't it? An unfinished building project, whoever thought it. But anyway, there it is. It just stands there. Now it's completely surrounded. It's being used. But this is the landscape. And this is the map. So here's Anzio and Nettuno down at the bottom. There's the Via Anzate. You can see the kind of lines. It's very flat. You've got the Mussolini Canal, which is, you know, part of, again, of this sort of reclamation project of these old Pontine marshes. And actually, that is the bank of the Mussolini Canal. And you definitely want to be, you know, that's a really useful barrier. You've got the canal and you've got this huge bank from which the Americans can sort of hidebind if they need to. But I'm showing you these pictures just so you get a kind of sense of the flatness of it. It's one of these sort of few flat areas in Italy. And here is Lucas. I mean, I'm sure if you met him, you'd think he was a really, really good bloke. I mean, he's incredibly likable. Again, he kept a very detailed diary, which is just fascinating. But he does it. He's no Patton. He's no Rommel. Frankly, he's not even Monty. I mean, you know, he's very ponderous. He's very cautious. And he's also kind of been struck down with the same disease as Fred Walker of the Texas Division, in that he just thinks this is not possible, that he's been sent off to do this job that, you know, unrealistic, you know, realistically, are we ever going to get to the Colli? What about that German counterattack? I can't fail. You know, and his fear of failure starts to kind of eat into him. And what it does is that even though they land 36,000 men, 3,000 vehicles on day one, even though there are no more than 800 German troops of varying kinds, and most of them are just service troops or troops passing from one place to another, on that day, in that whole Anzio area, he doesn't move. He just doesn't move. And his build-up is quite quick, but it's not as quick as the Germans, who by the end of the 22nd of April, D-Day for Shingle, have gone from 800 troops to 20,000. And you can say what you like about the Germans in Italy, but their operational skill is really second to none. That ability to divert troops, get people moving really, really quickly, is absolutely amazing. And he doesn't use the huge amount of armor that is building up. So in a matter of days, by the 27th of January, he's got something like 350 tanks in the Anzio bridgehead, and he just doesn't use them. And Clark and Alexander are going, come on, you've got to get a move on, keep going, when are you going to get going? Come on, and keep pushing him. And he keeps saying, well, you know, I'm trying to, but, you know, got to make sure that we've got our defenses and ducks in a row and all the rest of it. And it's not until the 30th of January that he finally sends his troops out. It's a really bad battle plan. The Ranger force gets decimated. The British 1st Division on the kind of on the western side managed to get all the way up to Campiglione Stazione, a railway halt, which is quite a long way further north. But they've got this huge, great salient, this sort of big, long thumb sticking out. And of course, salients are problematic because although you control the road, you're also really vulnerable from being attacked from the flanks. And of course, that's exactly what happens. On the 3rd of February, von Mackensen, who is the 14th Army commander, has now got enough troops in position to kind of attack down the Via Ranzate. Don't forget, it's very wet. This is the Pontine Marshes. They might be reclaimed, but it's still pretty soggy ground. So he's using the Via Ranzate as his main access. There's another little town called Aprilia, which is a new town created by Mussolini, and from the distance it just looks like a sort of industrial work. So the British nickname it the factory, and it was a dump then and it's still a dump now. It's a really, really uninspiring place. But all this armour that's here, it's not being used, and the British are left to defend the salient, the thumb as it's known, with almost no armour support whatsoever. And poor old General Penny, who's the commander of the British 1st Division, is screaming out, saying, please send me some reinforcements, send me some tank destroyers, send me some Shermans, and he just doesn't. He doesn't send them. And consequently, the salient gets reduced very quickly, and then they've got a bit of a battle on their hand. And to cut a long story short, the Germans counterattack down Campiglione twice. They retake the factory in the end of the first week of February, and then they launch their big counterattack, Fishfang, which is one of the best operational names ever. On the 16th of February. That doesn't work for the Germans, I'm glad to say. They just don't have enough of anything, and that's one of the big problems that you have in Italy, is attacking is really difficult. Attacking is really difficult wherever you are. You need, you know, to have a successful attack, you need overwhelming numbers. One of the big problems of the Germans, they might have quite a lot of armoured forces in the Anzio Bridgehead by this point. They might have quite a lot of troops. They've done this big reinforcement stuff, but they don't have enough firepower. They just do not have enough. They don't have enough shells. They don't have enough to compete against the buildup of the Allies, which has been very successful. And this is one of the landing ships, the aforementioned landing ships, about 120 meters long, take a huge amount of men and material and supplies. And what Mark Clark implements is the system of having trucks already loaded up. So you come from Naples, you load up the trucks just drive straight off. You don't unload the ships, you just drive off the trucks. They unload, the empty landing ship goes back. By the time they come back again with the next batch, the first lot of trucks can drive straight back onto it again. So you're going back empty, but you're not going back empty, if you see what I mean. You're also taking wounded back as well. And it's much more efficient. They get much more out of the landing ships. And actually, by the beginning of March, they're delivering something like 4,500 tons a day. Whereas German resupply in the whole of Italy, not just into the Anzio front, but right down to the Gustav line, is only about 1,200 tons a day. So that's a huge advantage to the Allies. And that logistical ability that the Allies have is just absolutely second to none, even when it's kind of thin on the ground, if you see what I mean. And here you can see these landing ships just disgorging straight onto the Bay of Anzio. And actually, it's quite interesting. You can go to Anzio now, and you can stand on the quayside there, and you can absolutely kind of sort of marry up that picture of where they're all coming out. But as you can see, Anzio is very, very bashed about. And one of the reasons it's bashed about is because, you know, the Germans do have firepower. They have Anzio Annie, these four railway guns. They don't have very much, but these shells are intermittently just hurtling over all the time. And Anzio just becomes this sort of, this kind of byword for awfulness. It's absolutely trench warfare, as you can see. The Seaview Hotel at Anzio, I mean, if you don't have a sense of humour, what have you got? But it's awful because actually the front lines end up being quite close. The final German offensive is launched on the 29th of February. There was a 29th of February in 1944. It's a leap year. Seitensprung, again, it absolutely does nothing. There's lots of interfering from Hitler, but perhaps more of that in a little bit. And it's just a horror story for all those involved. And one of the problems is that if you show your head in daytime, you're going to get sniped, you're going to get machine guns spattering at you from both sides, you'll get mortars raining down on you. There's lots of dead all over the place, and no one can get out and rescue them. So the stench is just appalling. It goes from kind of, you know, that you're in these trenches with kind of sort of ghastly filled with water. You've also got the Wadi system, which a lot of the British are. There's this weird, really weird landscape. And it's, you know, if you go out there today, it's still kind of weird. Because it goes from this sort of incredibly flat bit to suddenly you're in this area of kind of sort of undulating ground and these weird sort of, these little channels cut into the ground, you know, that once had rivers and sometimes have rivers when it's raining a lot and sometimes don't. And this acts like a, you know, imagine that as a kind of aerial view of the Western Front in 1917. That's the kind of the vibe. And it's deeply unpleasant for both sides. And I remember coming across a guy called Hans Liebschner, who was a company runner in the Guericke Kampfgruppe for the Germans, attached to the 4th Fallschirmjäger Division. And he's a runner, and there's one time where he finally gets back to kind of out of the lines, and he gets a kind of a meal of hot stew and potatoes, and he gets a fresh pair of trousers, and he picks up the mail, and with the mail also he gets a whole load of extra cigarettes, and he's really pleased. He just thinks, oh, all the lads are going to be so chuffed when I get back. And he's running back. Suddenly, whole stream of shells come over, and he has to kind of take cover, and he slips on the side of the bank and goes into this kind of sort of torrent which has started to build up at the bottom of one of the wadis, and he can't get out, and all the mail is getting ruined and the cigarettes are getting ruined, and there's butter in there as well which is sticking to the envelopes by the time he gets back, and he's covered in mud, and he gets back and he just bursts into tears. I mean who can blame him? So it's a horror story. And again, one of the things I've tried to do when I've been studying this is to really look in kind of 360 degrees and look at it from a kind of an Allied perspective, but also a German perspective as well. So S is for Strick, and this is John Strick, Captain John Strick. And you know, as we get to an age where living veterans are slipping away, Henry Rice excepted, of course, he was here yesterday. What do you do? You know, where do you get your kind of personal stories from? Well, I've been completely transfixed by the vast amount of diaries and letters I've been reading. They're so fascinating. I mean, L.P. Hartley might think the past is a foreign country, but it's not with these guys. I mean, honestly, their diaries, letters, you know, when they're well written and when they're kind of verbose, there's lots of them rather than just a one line. Their characters just ooze off every single page. And I was very, very struck looking at the papers of John Strick. He's an incredibly likable young man. He's 24 at this time. He's very clever. He's academic. He has literary aspirations as a poet. At school, he wasn't very good at sports and had a chip on his shoulder about not being good at rugger and cricket. So when he got out here, he tried to sort of compensate by becoming even more kind of gung-ho. And one of the things he did was he set up X Platoon, which was a kind of night raiding company from the first Royal, London Irish Rifles. And what he would do is he'd go out with this set bunch of people every time, and they would do night patrols, and they'd do very aggressive patrolling, and that was his kind of thing. So they'd each come out of their normal companies and platoons and just be this little squad that occasionally, from time to time, maybe once a week, maybe twice a week, would go out and do these night exercises. And in the early part of January, he's doing this all the time. He even would wander down to the River Gariano, dressed as an Italian, and in plain view, kind of walk up and down, observing where German positions were and stuff on the far side of the bank and all the rest of it. They're not involved in the initial crossing of the Gariano on the night of the 17th of January, but they are on the 18th. They're across, and they've been given the job of patrolling heavily into a little town called Castelforte, which is a little bit up from the floodplain of the Gariano, up into the hills, overlooked by Monte Damiano, and it's sort of rising up. There's a kind of sort of fissure between the two mountains, but it's kind of high up. And when you go into Castelforte, you sort of climb up it, and it's this kind of sort of linear kind of village that sort of looks like something out of Middle Earth. Anyway, he's up there doing this night patrol. And to cut a long story short, the Germans are still there. He hears them. They all start to freak out. Then they veer off the road. And when they veer off the road, they hit a mine. The guy just up behind him, Private Pyle with the Bren gun, is blown up into the air. He's blown 8 foot up into the air. He's lacerated but not severely wounded. Private Pyle loses both his feet. And at this point, Strick just has a complete breakdown. He's just sitting there. He just cannot cope. And he's already sent off Sergeant Murphy. There's a huge explosion. They try and find Sergeant Murphy, and they can't. And Strick, while he's kind of wounded and chattering and kind of in a complete state, is going back to the kind of first aid post, back away from Castelforte, back to the kind of battalion headquarters. And at the same time, he's feeling absolutely mortified that he might have left Sergeant Murphy, and that Sergeant Murphy might be somewhere in the middle of Castelforte, bleeding to death with no one to look over. And he's completely tortured by this. Anyway, to cut long and short, he gets sent to hospital. And there he starts resurrecting his diary. And here's other pictures of him. And this is his platoon. They look like a bunch of irregulars. And this is kind of the kind of vibe he's been trying to give. But it's just too much. You know, he's just seen too much action. You know, he's been absolutely in the thick of it in Sicily, and he's seen too much, and his tank of courage has just been exhausted. And this is part of his diary that he starts. The 22nd, the day has been immensely lazy and rather monotonous. But it's there you are. Every now and again, the deadly river with its steep, sloping, covered banks. Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. I live through the hideous scenes out Castelforte again. A marvel that I could have acted with so little wisdom. I mean, goodness. I mean, you can see he's absolutely being eaten up by this. Anyway, he sort of recovers, but not really. And he's back with the battalion by the 10th of February, by which point 56th Division, of which they're a part, has already been posted to Anzio, so away from the Garigliano, to join US 6th Corps in Anzio. He gets there on the 10th. Fishfang happens on the 16th. They're involved in a counterattack north towards the Bon Reposo Ridge, where they're trying to find the Oxen Bucks. And he gets hit by a shell and is obliterated, and that's him gone. And one of the things that's amazing about reading some of these diaries and letters is you're reading them, and then suddenly it stops. And you think, oh. And this horrible sort of chill comes over you, and you realize what must have happened. And almost always is exactly what has happened, which, you know, they've been killed or shot or blown to pieces. Strick is completely blown to pieces, and that's that. This kind of incredibly vivid character, this man of so much promise, this young man who's full of anxieties and worries and concerns, but laughs as well, and, you know, very, very real person that any one of us would recognize. A very, very well-defined man. And it's very upsetting, but it's one of the things I've really tried to do is try and kind of sort of use contemporary sources as much as I possibly can. So S is for stupidity. Gosh, I've only got 17 minutes left. Where do I start? This is Lieutenant General Sir Bernard Freyberg, VC. And obviously, if you had dinner with him, I think you'd think he was a jolly good bloke. He was obviously brave as a lion, all that kind of stuff. An immense character, had many, many virtues. But I think it's fair to say he's not the sharpest tool in the shed. As anyone who knows me will know, I am a massive fan of General, later Field Marshal, Alexander. I think he was absolutely the business. But I think if he makes one really bad decision in Italy, it is to create the New Zealand Corps at the very end of January 1944 to reinforce Fifth Army, US Fifth Army. So there's another country that's coming under, another nation that's coming under Clark's command. And he makes this up with the New Zealand Division, but also the 4th Indian Division. And the reason he does it is because of pressure from Churchill, who's a personal friend of Freyberg's, because Freyberg is the only three-star, Lieutenant General, Divisional Commander in 8th Army that could do this, and so seniority counts. And because he has had some form of commanding a corps before in Tunisia in early January 1943, where he kind of sort of didn't do anything too awful. So that's why he ends up being the senior commander, but they don't give him a corps staff. He's just expected to do everything with the existing staff. And the person who really has the vision for what should be done to try and unlock the casino position is Major General Chuka. Here's Alexander here with literally the coolest coat you could ever imagine. There's so many reasons why one should applaud Alexander, but his sartorial urbanity is very much high on the list, and I think we could all learn some lessons from him. Francis Chuka. Gertie to his friends, a very, very enlightened and brilliant commander, but one who is just a little bit careless with showing his frustration at other people's stupidity. And he's also got this problem that he's got rheumatoid arthritis, which can suddenly strike you down. And so just at lots of crucial moments in his career, just as he's the next man in line or whatever, he gets struck, and so his career takes a dip. But he gets there very early. At the end of January, and he goes around, he talks to General Juin, who is the commander of the French. He looks around the whole area and thinks, okay, I know what's going on. He says, I can see what went wrong with the Rapido. They didn't have enough covering fire. He's absolutely right. And what he's suggesting is a two-prong attack where they attack again around Sant'Angelo, but do it properly this time. And he's got a point. But also attack not at the Casino Massive at the end of the here's the Casino Massive. So this is Monte Trocchio. Here is Casino down here. This is the Casino Massive. You can see it sort of rising upwards, and you can't see Monte Cara there, but it raises up very dramatically. Here is the monastery up here, and he says you don't want to be going on the top of the. You don't want to be going on the end of the tip. That's the wrong place to attack, because if you attack there, you've got these very, very narrow ridges, and you can never put more than a company of men, you know, 100 men or so, along there in an attack, because there's not the space. So the consequence of that is that what you would do is you'd send 100, they'd get shot or wounded or smashed, then you send the next one, then you send the next one. It doesn't work, you want to overwhelm. And the place to overwhelm it is further back, where actually the ground is much more open, and it is. There's few of these kind of fissures, there's few of these ridges, where you can actually put in more men. And also, where the German defences are much weaker. And he convinces Freyberg of this. Freyberg says, yeah, okay, great, yeah, I love that plan. Unfortunately, he then gets struck down by rheumatoid arthritis. And he's absolutely debilitated, has to get sent off to hospital. But he keeps sending these missives out to to Freyberg. Freyberg's problem is, because he's a bit thick, he tends to be influenced by the last person he's spoken to. And when he then goes to talk to the Americans, Jeffrey Keyes, who has been the corps commander of the Rapido debacle, says, don't even insult me by suggesting that you can just get across where we didn't. So that one's out. And then someone else says, well, you know, getting mules up to kind of, you know, between Monte Carlo and Castellone, that's going to be a bit of a tricky. And Freyberg goes, yeah, okay, well, maybe we should just continue the same old way. So he reports this back. Tuca hears of it. Tuca says, this is absolutely insane. You really, really want to be doing pushing up between Castellone and Monte Carlo, where it's much easier. But if you don't, if you insist on going on the Monte Cassino Massive, there's only one way to reduce this. There's only one way, because there isn't the space for infantry to do an attack on its own. And that is to smother the whole of the Cassino Massive with heavy bombs. General purpose, 4,000-pound cookies. 2,000-pound cookies. He says, don't even think about sending Kitty bombers over. These are Kitty Hawks, single-engine planes with just a single bomb slung underneath them. Don't even think about 1,000-pounders. 1,000-pounders will be useless against this. And you're going to have to smother anything. And that is going to include the famous Benedictine Abbey of Monte Cassino. You know, and Tuca is a great lover of the arts. He's an artist himself. He's a very cultured man. He says, you know, this is not the way to go. But if you're going to insist upon it, if that's an order, that is the only way it'll work. Freyberg then goes to Clark and to the Air Forces and says, what we're going to have to do is I want 36 Kitty bombers to drop 1,000-pound bombs on Casino. It's just, you know, when you actually go and look at all the papers, the original papers, the original documents that there is going back and forth from Tuca from his hospital bed, from Clark to Al Grunter, his chief of staff, from Freyberg, and you look at it, you just think, how can you have been so stupid? How could you have got this so wrong? It is absolutely inexplicable. And what Freyberg does is what Tuca also says to him, he says, also, you have to coordinate this bombing with the infantry, knowing perfectly well that this is really, really hard to do. So his hope is that this will put them off. Oh, no, that doesn't happen at all. So the Air Force come over, and the biggest bomb they drop is 1,000-pounders. They don't send over 36 Kitty bombers, but they do send over the medium bombers and the heavy bombers as well. They only flatten the Abbey. That's what they're trying to hit, not the whole site. They don't send enough ordnance over, and it is not coordinated with the ground attack, and the whole thing is a complete disaster. This is the hill, so this is what they're trying to do. Actually, it doesn't really work, that map, does it, on this, because it's too small. But there you are. There you can see. That is the Abbey under attack on the 15th of February, 1944. Completely obliterated. There's Monte Carlo. So this is... Will this work? Oh, no. Okay, can you see the little sort of puff of smoke in the middle? That's roughly where Tuca's saying it'd be much better to attack. And he's completely right. I mean, he is completely, totally right. That would have been a much, much better bet. Because actually, the Germans haven't got very many troops up there. They're ripe for the plucking. But you cannot attack up that end because they've got these ridge lines covered. And what they've got is they've got a figure of eight kind of set up of defences and machine guns and mortars and all the rest of it. Which has its focal point on a point called point 593, which is the end of a ridge, which then drops off very suddenly. And you can capture this But unless you overwhelm more than 50% of the two rings, this figure of eight, of which 0.993 is the apex of the figure of eight, you're never going to hold it for good because you're going to have enfilading fire from coming from either side. And the Allies just don't understand that defensive system. They don't know that, and they just don't. Senior commanders haven't gone up onto the ridges and checked it out for themselves and realised the big problems with it. The Fallschirmjäger are looking up at the bombers. Hardly any of them get killed. Every of them just thinks, well, where's the attack coming? It doesn't come until the following night. They try and do attack 0.593. It doesn't work. They try again. It doesn't work. The whole thing's a complete disaster. And it is all, frankly, in my humble opinion, Freyberg's fault. And that is the end of one of the richest religious and cultural treasures in Europe after Freyberg's misguided attack. Clark is completely against it. He says, I would not do this. Alexander overrules him. He says, if you're asking people to do this attack and that's what they feel they need to do it, we've got to do it. It's regrettable, but this is what we've got to do. And Clark just goes, this guy's an absolute idiot. You know, why have you lumbered me with him? He can't do anything about it because it's political. He's also been told when Freyberg takes over by Alexander, Alexander says, tread carefully. These are New Zealanders. They've got a little bit of a mutiny going on in New Zealand at the time. 6,000 of their best troops have been sent home on furlough schemes. You know, morale is not very good. I mean, it's hardly a kind of ringing endorsement. And this is on the 22nd of February. They're still bombing it pointlessly. But then comes the attack on Casino Town. So by this point, Freyberg goes, actually, do you know what we really need to do? If you're going to win, attack and destroy the town, what we really need is overwhelming force with 4,000-pound general-purpose bombs. Let's completely destroy it. So he then adopts Tucker's plan for Monte Cassino, but onto Casino Town. Unfortunately, he then doesn't, and this is Casino Town being bombed on the 15th of March, and it is just so awful, I can't tell you. There it is, look, under attack. This town is utterly, utterly, totally destroyed. There's not a single building that is left intact. It's just these sort of skeletal walls. He then sends in only two battalions of infantry to clear the town. Now, if you're going to do this, what you then need to do is absolutely overwhelm the you absolutely need to overwhelm the town with infantry and just completely charge through. None of that happens. He's got 78th Division waiting for him, not used at all. He's so worried about losing New Zealander lives that he hardly sends anyone at all. The Indians go up, are told to attack directly up the steepest part of the hill. As you can see, this is a terrible place to fight because there's almost no soil. So every mortar shell that lands, every artillery shell that lands is exaggerated in its destructive power because not only is it not being absorbed by the soil and by the ground, it's also sending out splinters of razor-sharp bits of stone. So what a surprise, it doesn't work. And again, you know, I mean, look at that. I mean, what a joke. I mean, how could you possibly, and this is the desolation of Casino Town. It is truly, truly shocking. It is, you know, if Monte Cassino battles in the middle of February were a terrible plan, the battle plan for Casino Town is even worse. And Clark in his diary is just going, this guy is an absolute idiot, and he's a pain in the ass, and he's completely annoying, and I don't really like him, and I'm being lumbered with him, and I can't do anything. You know, why isn't he sending in the infantry? You know, Clark urges them to build the Cavendish Road, which is his road up the back, and he wants to have a two-pronged attack. You know, the Indians, if Indians are going, let's overwhelm the Bateman, for example, Brigadier Bateman of the 5th Indian or is it the 7th? Doesn't matter. He's one of the brigadiers of the Indian Infantry Brigade. He's going, we've got to smother this area. And again, not enough troops being sent in. So it's an absolute disaster. I'm going to really have to crack on because I've got quite a long way to go and I've only got 5 minutes left. I is for innocence. So I don't want to be rushing over this. But Italy is a country of 40 million people in 1939. It is the great misfortune that the vast majority of them live exactly where the Allies are trying to move forward for precisely the same reason that they're living there. This is the easiest place to get around. It's where the roads are. It's near the coast, all the rest of it. And the displacement of people, the abandonment of the people is just absolutely shocking. A lot of the men force have gone to slave labour in Germany, rounded up by the Germans, or they've earlier been taken prisoner of war by the Allies and are now helping on farms in Wiltshire or in the prairies of Canada or whatever. So they're around. The women having to fend for themselves. They're impoverished. There's absolutely chronic inflation, terrible inflation, infrastructure's been completely destroyed. I mean, we've all seen images of Mariupol. It's kind of like that. The whole of this fabric of society just completely destroyed. Casino is 100% destroyed. Pignatoro is 95% destroyed. San Savaro is completely destroyed. San Vittore is completely destroyed. Belmonte is completely destroyed. And when I say completely destroyed, that means not a single house left intact. Frosinone later on is completely destroyed. I mean, it is just horrendous. And when you go there now, I mean, Casino is an absolutely beautiful part of the world, but all the villages and all the towns, you can see they're all new villages. They've been completely rebuilt since the war, and just without any of the charm that they would have had they been around. And one of the most disgusting aspects of it is the huge amount of prostitution. I mean, the Fifth Army Chief Medical Officer reckons there are at least 50% of all available women, this is his term, have some kind of sexually transmitted disease by the spring of 1944. I mean, literally everyone all women are kind of sort of, a huge number of women are turning to prostitution, and families are prostituting their daughters. This is a 14-year-old girl who's been prostituted by her family and who has been picked up by the Allies and sent to a kind of refuge. I mean, look at that face. I mean, if that's not haunting, I don't know what is. The black market thrives. It is a period of absolute appalling misery for the Italians, and they are left without, you know, the Allies do what they can. They have kind of camps and hand out food and stuff, but it's never enough because the ground forces don't have enough. So there's constant sort of battle of supplies, and, you know, it's tough on the Italians, but, you know, they didn't have to go to war in June 1940, et cetera, et cetera. There's a bit of that going on. And it's just appalling, and I really wanted to, in the work I've just been doing, I really wanted to kind of underline that point. N is for Nazis. Hitler, unfortunately, when Kesselring in the September 1943 decides to fight very heavily at Salerno, this catches the attention of Hitler, who had previously planned to retreat to the Pisa Rimini line, which is about 200 miles north of Rome. The problem with that is now the Hitlerian spotlight is on Kesselring, who is a Luftwaffe field marshal but is the overall commander in Italy. And Hitler is just constantly meddling, and he decides you cannot, you know, you must fight for every single yard, we must never retreat, blah, 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 blah. And what this leads is to the most grotesque mismanagement of frontline troops you've ever seen. I mean, generally speaking, now, if you lose 30% of your frontline strength, that unit would be considered no longer fit for combat and would be pulled out. You're having situations where German units are fighting with single-digit percentage of what they should be. So when the 1st Fallschirmjäger Division, for example, get moved over to the Casino front, they're at about 2,500 strong. You know, they're supposed to be a division of nearly 20,000. They've got 2,500 in total. You have, there's a diary that I follow of a chap called Jörg Zellner, who is a major in the 134th Infantry Regiment, and his battalion is supposed to be, you know, 900 men. He quite often has 16. And 32, and then he gets a replacement of some teenagers and some middle-aged lawyers, and that pulls his battalion up to about 70. And it's just, it's so appalling. You know, what Kesselring constantly is doing is just firefighting. He's taking one thing that, you know, you have a situation where the 134th Infantry Regiment is part of 44th Division, but is actually fighting for the 29th Panzer Grenadier Division, whilst another unit of the 44th unit is fighting for the 15th Panzer Grenadier Division. They're all mixed up. There's absolutely no unit cohesion whatsoever. The whole thing is just an utter mess. And every single one of his commanders, apart from him, is going, you know what we should do? We should pull back from the Gustav Line and go behind the Caesar Line. Only Kesselring is saying, no. We're going to keep it. This is Kesselring on the left. This is von Senger, who's generally considered as a good German. He's a good Catholic boy. He's very learned. He doesn't like Hitler, but he's still fighting for him. You know, he doesn't have to. He could have resigned. So he's still there as well. So I don't think he's quite as good as everyone makes out either. The other thing about it is when you look at photographs, you go to the German archives and you look at photographs of Casino, of Anzio, they're all Fallschirmjäger. Okay, and these are the German paratroopers. It's all about the Fallschirmjäger, the Green Devils of Casino and all the rest of it. All the photos are there, and this is entirely the makeup of Goebbels, the propaganda minister, who goes, we're going to make sure that we elevate these people. They're no real better than anyone else. They've got a hard core of people who are quite good. But that is about it. Of Russians, as they call themselves, who've been on the Eastern Front, who've been in Crete, who've been in Sicily. But the vast majority of the men are teenagers, 17 and 18-year-olds who are very wet behind the ears, don't know anything, but they are German. And that's where the Falschenjäger are different from others. They are all German. They're not kind of soldiers in German uniform, which is what a lot of other divisions are. And it is amazing that this myth, this Nazi myth of the invincibility of the Fallschirmjäger, of the dominance of the Fallschirmjäger, even when 1st Fallschirmjäger Division is only 2,500 men out of, 150,000 or whatever, you would think that they are running the entire show, and they're not. These are three of the guys involved. These are kind of Kratzert and Dont on the left and the middle. And this is Heilmann, Mad Ludwig Heilmann, King Ludwig of the 3rd Fallschirmjäger Regiment, and Heydrich, the divisional commander, on the right. But I left the Bundes archive on there just to kind of prove the point that when you're searching up for the German archives, that's all you're going to find. If you want to find other German troops, forget it. You won't find them. Only Fallschirmjäger. And so it's amazing how this myth continues. You'll be pleased to know that I'm nearly there. O is for Overlord, and the tyranny of Overlord, the primacy of Operation Overlord, which of course is D-Day, the cross-channel invasion, the 80th anniversary we've just had, dominates everything that's going on in Italy the whole time. It dominates the policies. It's why Anzio is undercooked. It's why the whole campaign is undercooked in the first place. What is amazing, though, is that despite this, Operation Diadem is a great, great triumph. And this is the final battle for Rome, launched by Alexander on the 11th of May, 1944. It is the battle that includes the two Polish corps, about whom I've not really spoken today, who finally take the peaks, finally understand the figure of eight defensive system after rigorous patrol work, after their first attack doesn't work. And they do get to Rome, and they get to Rome on the 4th of June, and finally, these are all scenes from the 5th of June, the day before D-Day. And very briefly, Rome and the Italian campaign and Mark Clark and Alexander, they are the kind of heroes of the moment. They're on the front covers of every newspaper in the free world. They're on the press ports and all the rest of it. And then it's D-Day, and it's all over for Italy, except, of course, it isn't all over for Italy, and it's certainly not over for all those poor soldiers, those poor bastards who have to fight through this in this incredibly inhospitable terrain. Awful in winter because of the rain and the cold and the mountains. Awful in summer because of the immense amount of heat and dust and putrefying bodies and, oh God, and yet more mountains. It's a miserable old story, I'm not going to lie. But it's also curiously compelling. And the work I've just completed, I'm literally going to sign off on my casino book next week. As soon as this festival is over, I've got 150 pages I've got to proofread still. And then I'm finally done. And that will be my fourth book on Italy. But it's a subject that is just so fascinating, so interesting. And the geography, the characters, the suffering of the civilians, the suffering of the soldiers, both sides caught up in this absolute mess. These characters that I've been reading about in the diaries and the letters and so on, it's absolutely consumed me. It's been so interesting. It's been such a privilege to write about. And I'm afraid I've just, I know I've gobbled on, but I've just touched the kind of edges of it, really. But I wanted to leave you with just a few of my thoughts as I put the Italian campaign to bed, finally. Thank you all very much for listening.